When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
BSM presents The Tim Meisberg Show, streaming live on WBSM.com and the WBSM app. Call 508-996-0500. Send us app chat messages and open line voicemails using the WBSM app. Now, The Tim Meisberg Show.
Welcome back in. Third and final hour of the program here on Friday morning. And a little change in the schedule here. We have joining us now Jack Spillane of New Bedford Light. Good morning, Jack.
Hey there.
And before we start turning on the light officially and we get into your column, I just want to get your thoughts on this Paul Kodera situation. As I was saying to you off the air and as I've been saying during the course of the morning, I don't think anybody's surprised that it came back as, you know, the DA's office ruling this police-involved shooting as being justified, but it's the details of what was exactly went down as part of this that I think answers a lot of questions for people.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that you would think that his, if you want to call it suicide by cop, was precipitated by his feud with the city, more than a feud, his legal fight with the city over his pension and the circumstances under which he was fired. We all know the tale of the investigation of his being out on a back injury and the city having evidence that the injury was not that bad. A civil service looked into that and they found that he was justified in being out. The regulations are what the regulations are. It's just a tragic situation for all concerned. And you know, it's one of those situations where you can kind of see it coming, and yet no one seems to be able to stop it. You know, I haven't read the report yet, but I read the Boston Globe story this morning, and it just seems that his friends tried to help him, his colleagues tried. The cops probably gave him more benefit than they might give somebody else who was in a similar situation. It just seems like he was out of control, very, very drunk. I think that there are some questions about the Bayside to be raised. There are some questions about the people who were with him while he was drinking that much. If you've ever been with someone, and we all have, that's drinking like that, it's hard to, you know, people have their own free will, and they do what they do. But it just is a tragic end for a man who had many good years as a New Bedford firefighter, and it's sad to see it happen.
I mean, not that it should really matter, but I was looking at a chart that basically says, so, and I'm just estimating that, you know, Paul Kodera was around, you know, 180 to 200 pounds. I'm just estimating that. I don't even know if that's true, but, you know, if that's the case, and it said to have a blood alcohol content like he had, you know, I think it was 0.202, so to get to that level, he would have had eight beers to get to that level. But, you know, we know for a fact from one of the witnesses he had at least two rounds of shots. So, you know, it's, you can say, was he overserved for the amount of time that he was there? He was there for, at the point that all of this started to happen, you know, he'd been there for about 6 hours at that point. So
My understanding is that he was also on medication from you know, we talked off here about the
pain medication and a new medication.
So I don't know whether that medication mixed with the alcohol had an effect, whether his general, whether he had a depression about his circumstances or whatever. There's a lot of ingredients that go into this. It's a tragedy. I mean, some people may want to blame the mayor or the city. I think the city had a point of view about him, whether they were justified in firing him. Civil service said no. The mayor, I think, earnestly felt that as fire chief, you know, him being out on leave for so long and doing some physical activity was a poor example to set for the rest of the department. So I can see it from both ways. Like, you know.
And I think it's important to note, too, that when the city does something like this, when they fire the acting police chief and then when they try to block the pension, they're not doing it as a Mitchell versus Paul Kodera situation. Their approach is, or at least the, you know, their rationale is that they tell us is, you know, we're protecting the integrity of the department, as you said, because you don't want this person to be leading the entire department and taking advantage of the situation. And then also they feel like they're protecting the taxpayers too, because they're saying this guy is defrauding you, the taxpayers, of money that you're paying to go to support this. So I think people will come away with this too easily and look at it as a John Mitchell versus Paul Kodera fight, but I don't know that the city would characterize it that way.
Yeah. There are issues on both sides. At the Standard Times, because I was the news editor at the time, we had issues with Acting Chief Kodera returning our phone calls on fires and things, whether that was related to his physical problems or what. At a certain point, they told us to call Deputy Chief Kruger, you know, which had never happened before in my years. So I think that there were some performance issues there. Maybe he had good reasons for them. The civil service certainly thought so. I haven't, you know, read that report either. So, you know, it's a tragic situation. He thought he had won his case. The city had announced its determination to appeal, which is the city's right. And I think the city felt that, yes, civil service ruled on his behalf, but they wanted to fight this for the principle that they thought was important. You know, it really is different when a department head, and I'm not saying that that's what he was doing it because civil service found elsewhere, but if you believe a department head is abusing sick time or vacation time policy, it's different than just a run-of-the-mill worker is doing it. Like, well, and it's not the first time I think it's happened in the city.
Now, everybody, you know, the witnesses and his wife, they all said that, you know, this set him off. Getting the phone call while he was at the bar that they were appealing set him off. But as you said, anybody that's followed the way that the city does business should have known that there would have been an appeal of this.
Well, I don't know that the city knew he was at a bar when they called him.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean.
but he should have been preparing for the fact that they were going to appeal.
Yeah. Yeah. My understanding is that he was out celebrating his victory. And it sounds like the events cascaded from there.
Well, if you want to read the full report, we have it at WBSM.com and on the app. If you read my story there toward the bottom, we have a link to be able to read the entire report. But now we have another story to get to, a very, very important story. But before we do that, let me cue up the Rolling Stones. We're getting two royalty checks from us this week.
Could I think, get
And of course, Jax Blaine is the semi-retired columnist for New Bedford Light, but he has a new column this week that just came out that is a very important story following up on some of the reporting of Colin Hogan.
Yes, Colin Hogan a couple weeks ago had done, one of our reporters at the Light had done a great story on, and I didn't even know this, that segregation still exists, not just in the New Bedford school system, but in many school systems across the country, particularly urban school systems. It was explained to me that there are two kinds of segregation. De jure, which is the kind of segregation in the Old South, where by law, people of different races could not go to school in the same schools. That has somewhat gone away because of civil rights decisions. But there is also de facto segregation, which is in reality, segregation exists because of the way boundaries are drawn or because of the way policy has been set, the way school districts are configured. And in that case, New Bedford was found to have 9 district schools. I believe it was 7 elementaries, 1 middle school, the Roosevelt, and the Whaling City Alternative School that was segregated, as well as Alma Del Mar Charter School. And I think it was something like 10 out of 23 schools in the city. The other cities were found to be racially diverse. All of the schools that were found to be segregated were predominantly schools of color. So they weren't segregated, you know, to be all white. It was their neighborhoods, the boundaries were configured so that they were all either black or Latino. You know, I wrote the launching point for this column was I had written a column 19 years ago when they first started discussing building a new school in the peninsula. And my suggestion was that they build one school because at that time enrollment had gone down, and I thought it would be good to mix middle class neighborhoods on the tip of the peninsula with working class neighborhoods, lower income neighborhoods in the north part of the peninsula. Both Mayor Lang and Mayor Mitchell didn't like that idea for different reasons. Mayor Lang said that there was no call for it from the neighborhoods. But I felt that when you mix different groups, what you get, and a lot of it is segregation by income, even more than segregation by color, which I think is the way it really works in New Bedford. That there was no call, Mayor Lang said, to do that. Mayor Lang can defend himself. I linked the story because I felt that was important to do. But what happens when you mix, in my opinion, middle income parents and their kids with people from less privileged backgrounds, they do great modeling for the other kids, and kids say that there's a different way to have good study habits, to take academics seriously, than if you have homogeneous schools. And I felt that because a lot of middle class neighborhoods in New Bedford are closely located by to the lower income neighborhoods. It's less than a mile, you know, that you could configure the boundaries so that you could mix them more. So there's never been any interest in it. And maybe I'm wrong, you know, it's just my opinion. But when I saw Colin's segregation story and the fact that the state itself still labels these schools as segregated, and the Supreme Court evidently made a decision in 1991 that as long as there had been progress made, you didn't have to, you know, follow these busing rules. And I am not suggesting busing in any way. That was bringing kids to schools from a distance. I'm talking about neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. You can mix these schools with very little effort by just tweaking the boundaries a little bit. I talked to Superintendent O'Leary about that. He said he wouldn't necessarily be against it, but that it would have to come for the community. Superintendent O'Leary is more interested in getting more money for these segregated schools. And the Massachusetts School Building Authority, I've written about this too, the way the formula works now, it skews to the suburbs because the suburbs are the ones that can afford to build new schools. And so you read about all the suburbs building Taj Mahal new high schools when their high schools are already younger than New Bedford's high school. And New Bedford also, until very recently, still had 8 100-year-old elementary schools. So the urban centers have lagged behind the suburbs in getting new schools because even when they get on the MSBA list, they often get shot down by the city councils because the local taxpayers can't afford it.
They can't raise their portion of what they would have to pay.
While the suburbs can afford it. So we still have de facto segregation, not de jure segregation.
Well, and you talk about in the column, and this is what you had proposed, you know, 19 years ago, was that it just would take a change in the direction in which they make the borders for who goes to these schools.
Mainly in New Bedford go north-south, so that the schools along the river, their districts go north-south, and the schools inland go north-south. I think the exception to that is the peninsula, but the peninsula boundaries, you do have 2 schools. They built 2 schools there. You could just have the peninsula boundaries go north-south in that particular case, and then you'd have one school with the northern half of the eastern peninsula, you know, with the southern half and the northern half of the western peninsula with the southern half, and you could mix the schools that way. I'm sure it wouldn't be exactly that, but you could do that. That's one solution. I think Andrew O'Leary's solution, that the formula for more resources for these districts is a good one too. But I just think it's worth talking about, and I hadn't realized that there still is a feeling of segregation. The racial imbalance, the name of the state agency that found the segregation, I want to make sure I get this right, is the Racial Imbalance Advisory Council. They asked the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, what are they doing? Are they informing the districts that you're out of compliance? Because there used to be severe penalties, like you could lose your school building funding, you could lose your right to be exempted from school choice things. And that's another issue that Superintendent O'Leary has brought out, is we're getting segregation from the way that people opt into the Voc-Tech school and the charter schools, because they can choose their student bodies, whereas the New Bedford districts have to take whoever comes in the door. So there's a lot to it. I don't want the column to be misunderstood. I don't expect that any of the middle-class neighborhoods in New Bedford will willingly have their districts reconfigured, because parents care about their children. They don't want them to have less than they already have. So I think that in the long term, as we've seen these last 50 years, it's going to have to be about improving these low-income district schools, and I hope we can find a way to do that.
So I just want to reiterate here that, as you said, this was an organization that found this and that, reported this. This is not New Bedford Light trying to say that New Bedford schools are segregated. This isn't trying to cause controversy here. This is an agency that found this, and New Bedford Light is just reporting on it.
Yes, it's a state agency. The Racial Imbalance Advisory Council is part of the state.
There are people listening right now yelling at the radio, there's no segregation anymore in schools.
But I'm not disagreeing with them. I'm agreeing with them. I'm just trying to put forward possible solutions. And I'm not under the illusion that my solution is the only one or the best one. But I do think that, I don't think any of these middle-class neighborhoods are going to willingly change their boundaries. We've already seen how hard Voc-Tech has, and the charter school is not quite as, they've been, in New Bedford, they've been willing, but the teachers union have not been willing to let the way that students are chosen for the charter schools change. But there are different solutions that can be done, but there still is a problem that the districts are too homogenous.
Right, and that's the argument that people will make. Well, they'll say, well, the city can't help who lives in what neighborhoods, but as you're saying, they can help how they create these districts, borders, so that they could change the makeup.
New Bedford is very densely populated. Sometimes, you just happen to be like a couple of blocks further from one school than another, and, they're just, the boundaries are drawn, They look like middle-class neighborhoods have their boundaries.
It doesn't help that every kid has to walk to school, too, but that's a different thing.
Everybody wants to walk to school?
No, that everybody has to walk to school. That they if you live within a certain distance, you have to walk to school.
Yes. Well, that's the way it was when I was a kid.
Yeah, but that doesn't help in this situation. Yeah. We got to take a break here. We'll be back in just a few moments. 508-996-0500. Back with more with Jack Spillane in just a moment. All right, welcome back in. We are turning on the light with Jack Spillane of New Bedford Light. We are going to be going into the news in just a moment, so we'll kind of hold off on getting into the next topic. But certainly this topic about the segregation issue in schools, I think this, as the New Bedford Light does, is shining a light on the issue, and we're going to hear more about this going forward.
Yeah, and again, it is a state agency that has said, the schools, not just in New Bedford, but many across the state, are segregated.
But as you point out, the state agency also fails to really enforce the policies here.
So you have
one
state agency and then another state asking another state agency, what are you going to do about this? And they're not going to do anything about it. And there hasn't really, to be fair, anything done for 30 years on this topic. Busing was the last great effort to solve that, and that was disastrous. I certainly would not be suggesting busing again, because that's taking kids out of their own neighborhoods. We're talking about, you may be a half a mile from this school and three quarters of a mile from that school, and you're going to go to a different school, not going across town like they did in Boston. And to be fair, there are many people who have long argued that the suburbs should be involved in this, because the suburbs, which grew up after World War II, are almost universally white. And in Colin's story, he showed how the Duval School, which is in the south end of New Bedford, just across the line from Dartmouth, is, I think, if I remember correctly, was 53% minority, where English language learners. And the ELL in DeMello, which is just over the line in Dartmouth, was like 4%. You know, so these are neighborhoods that are directly adjacent to them. Anybody that knows Dartmouth knows that the initial streets in Dartmouth are all triple-deckers. They're the same multifamily neighborhoods as New Bedford, you know.
Well, we can talk more about this coming up right now, though. We've got Phil Devitt ready to give us all the top stories of the day in the WBSM newsroom.
Debbie brings rain and wind to the Northeast. At least one debate now set for Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. And an Ohio woman says she witnessed a Virgin Mary miracle.
From the WBSM newsroom, this is WBSM News.
Debbie has been downgraded to a tropical depression, but is still a dangerous storm. In addition to heavy rain and strong winds, the Mid-Atlantic has been under a tornado watch. The Northeast is also bracing for Debbie, which could dump up to 4 inches of rain today from Pennsylvania to New England. Your full forecast is coming up. Donald Trump says he has agreed to 3 debates in September against VP Kamala Harris. At a press event from his Mar-a-Lago home in Florida, Trump said the debates would be on Fox News, ABC, and NBC.
But I look forward to the debates because I think we have to set the record straight. Why is it that millions of people were allowed to come into our country from prisons, from jails, from mental institutions, insane asylums?
At least one debate is now set. ABC News announced Trump and Harris agreed to a debate on September 10th. The two tickets have been engaged in a back and forth over a debate agreement. The shooter at former President Trump's July 13th rally spent nearly a year practicing at a shooting range. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley released documents yesterday showing Thomas Crooks joined a sportsman's club in August of last year and made over 40 visits. Investigators say Crooks was less than 150 yards away from the stage where Trump was standing when he fired the shot that grazed the former president's ear. Microsoft says hackers based in Iran have been trying to break into the account of a high-ranking official on the U.S. presidential campaign. The internet researchers say the hacks discovered last June were part of Iran's continued attempts to influence the U.S. presidential election. Their report did not mention the high-ranking official by name. Officials in Austria say an 18-year-old Iraqi national is being detained in connection with an alleged plot to attack 3 Taylor Swift concerts in Vienna. The arrest comes after a 19-year-old Austrian suspect reportedly confessed on Thursday that he planned to kill himself and a large number of people using explosive devices. The concerts were canceled. The California Park Fire north of Sacramento has destroyed more than 427,000 acres, and it's still burning. The fire was only 34% contained as of last night. The Park Fire is currently the largest wildfire in the U.S.
Boar's Head recently recalled 7 million pounds of meat products following 2 other listeria deaths, one in New Jersey and the other in Illinois. On Thursday, the CDC announced a 3rd person had died from the listeria outbreak in Virginia. The total number of people who have gotten sick is up to 43 across over a dozen states. Nearly all of them had to be hospitalized from the illness. This latest recall involves liverwurst, ham, bologna, and beef salami made at a Boar's Head plant in Virginia. More than 70 products with sell-by dates spanning from July 29th to October 17th are involved. I'm Tammy Trujillo.
And an Ohio woman says she saw a statue of the Virgin Mary opening and closing its eyes, but church officials are skeptical. Connie Liptak told local news that she took pictures of the miracle while the International Pilgrim Virgin statue of Our Lady of Fatima was on a tour stop in Ohio. The Reverend David Misbrenner, who leads the church where the alleged miracle supposedly occurred, says he's not so sure. He said that anything can happen with a camera, and the church is very cautious when it comes to these kinds of things. The statue is on a U.S. tour set to end in September.
WBSM Sports.
Patriots beat the Carolina Panthers 17-3 in their season opener last night at Gillette Stadium. Next home game Thursday with the Philadelphia Eagles. And the Red Sox are scheduled to return to Fenway tonight, hosting the Houston Astros for a 3-game series with the first pitch set for 7:10.
Now, your ABC 6 South Coast forecast.
As the remnants of Debbie make a presence across our immediate area, humidity is on the rise with the chance for showers this morning. Temperature in the mid-70s, near 80 this afternoon, scattered showers. Also, overnight is when we should experience the bulk of this unsettled weather, showers and thunderstorms with fog. Gusty winds, mid-70s. Tomorrow, considerable improvement. From the ABC 6 Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Ceci del Carmen on New Bedford News Talk Station 1420 WBSM.
This WBSM news update brought to you by Stevie's Wine and Spirits. Look for the purple dot to try before you buy, only at Stevie's Wine and Spirits in Fairhaven. I'm Phil Devitt for WBSM News. Stay up to date with New Bedford's News Talk Station WBSM and get all of our content and breaking news alerts with the WBSM app.
Welcome back in. It is Friday morning. We will be turning on the light with Jax Moore in just a second. But right now, we are joined by Eric over at the Butcher Shop. Good morning, sir. How are you doing today?
Hey, what's up, Tim? How you doing, brother?
Doing all right. What's going on over there this weekend?
A lot of everything, man. Summer's coming to the end. You know what I'm saying? A lot of grilling still left to do. And people should come out and get some nice tomahawks. A lot of stuff I got. Pork chop, whatever they want. It's grilling season still.
You know, I got a question last week after we had you on the air. Somebody said, next time you have Eric on, can you have him describe the difference between a celebrity pork chop and a regular pork chop?
Everybody asks me that all the time, dude. And you know what I say? I don't know. Ask the experts. I have no idea. I know they're more tender, a lot more tender. They don't dry out. The actual details of how they do it or whatever, I don't know.
But you've talked to us before about how it's more like a steak. Like, you can actually cook it to different degrees. Some people like it more well done than others. I mean, it's something that has a much more versatile cooking ability.
Well, more versatile than chicken. Yeah, chicken you always got to cook all the way. But the pork, some people do medium rare with pork and stuff like that. So, you know, everything's possible.
And, of course, as you said, not only is summer coming to an end, but football season has started. I know it's the preseason, but people still want to have, you know, food to munch on during the games.
Well, wings. Everybody wants wings. I got wings, nice party wings. They're all cut down. They're really nice, and they're big, and they're hearty. And if you want them, I got them.
And, of course, all the beer and wine everybody needs for their tailgating, you have that, too?
Beer and wine, cotton and spit. I got whatever you need, man.
Oh, yeah. See, that we talked about it last week. You can keep the feast going all summer long by going to the butcher shop.
You can bring it at the wintertime if you want, dude. It don't matter.
And I always ask you this. What are you going to have this weekend?
I'm going to have, you know what? Not just in celebrity pork chops. I think I'm going to have one of those, man.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea. What do you like? How do you like to prepare your pork chops?
Like 155, brother. Right on the grill, nice and quick.
Little seasoning. Do you like to marinate it?
Salt, pepper. Easy. Doesn't need much. That pork chop's got a lot of flavor to it too, man. It's a nice chop.
Sounds good. Maybe I'll stop by and get some myself.
You sure?
All right. Well, you have a great week. We will talk to you next week.
All right, brother. I got you, man.
All right. That is Eric over at the Butcher Shop, 123 Dartmouth Street in New Bedford, a real old school neighborhood market. Great meats, great service, great family, the Pinaretta family. Stop by and see them. So, Jack, what do you like to throw in the grill?
Yeah, you know, it's a great place. I try to be chicken and fish nowadays. Salmon is a big one for me. But once in a while, I have a steak. And I love hamburgers, but not too often anymore at my age.
Well, I'll say this. Salmon, As much as I love cooking fish on the grill, salmon is something I do pretty much exclusively in the air fryer now.
Ah.
Comes out so good.
Yeah.
So if you like salmon, that's the way to do it.
Comes out good on the grill, too.
It does. It does. But I also find that the air fryer doesn't dry it out as much as the grill can if you're not careful. The only downside is when you're cooking it outside on the grill, you don't get fish smell in your house. But when you're cooking it in the air fryer, you might get a little bit of that. So we were talking about, you know, the column that Jack has up now at newbedfordlight.org. But there's also some big news that came out of the New Bedford Light this week with a new editor on board.
Yes, we're very excited. This is just a really exciting opportunity for the New Bedford Light. We just have a nationally known editor in Karen Bordalo, former longtime editor of the Providence Journal, recently the executive editor at the Walter Cronkite School in Arizona at Arizona State University, a community editor at the Woonsocket Call for a long time. So we're just so excited about the opportunity to have an editor of this quality come to New Bedford. She's going to move to the area. It's just a great opportunity. We have had a great start under Bobby Rossner and Andy Tomalonis, but they're up in my age bracket, so it's time for some younger blood to take over, and Karen will be starting in October.
And it says here in the article that Karen will be working alongside Andy, but that Andy's going to retire in 2025.
Yes, in 2025.
So I guess he's finally made the decision that he just wants to garden full time.
Well, you know, Andy's a multi-talented guy. You know, Tim is referring to the gardening books that Andy has written. You know, I don't know what Andy will do. He's a very talented guy.
He is.
But I think anybody who has done the day-to-day grind of journalism knows that it's a grind. It's like radio, and it's a younger person's game.
I will say I learned so many things from various people that I work with at the Standard Times. But Andy was certainly one of them. I mean, he was somebody that made me not only be a better writer, but want to be a better writer for the product he was putting out.
Very talented writer, designer, editor. Andy has it all.
So, and now with this new person coming in, now there's a quote here that says, from Karen, that says, "I believe that the power of journalism can affect change and help transform a community. Since its founding 3 short years ago, the New Bedford Light has already made a huge impact in this area. I am excited and grateful to be joining this incredibly dedicated team." And of course, those are the, you know, the kind of discussions that you have when you're first. But I want to know what really draws her to New Bedford. I want to know what stories she thinks, you know, are going to be told. I bet you she has a lot of ideas of great things that the Light can do on top of what you've already been able to do.
Well, when we were doing our searches, we met the finalist candidates, the staff did, and she was very well prepared. She knew the city. She knew the issues with the fishing industry, wind turbines, the economic development issues that are here, the issues of crime, education. There are so many areas to do, environment, Karen Bordalo was well acquainted with what we have been doing, you know, with Will Sennett's wonderful stories about the internationalization of the fishing industry, the stories that we've done across the board on any variety of investigative subjects. She's going to... you may know Karen because she was the editor at the Providence Journal at the time of the station night fire, and they did a long series interviewing the families of all the victims, and there were 100, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, which, as we know, is the biggest prize in journalism. So this is a quality editor coming to New Bedford.
And that's kind of what I was alluding to with my point there, is like that she made her name on these investigative deep dive series, and that's just going to fit in perfectly with the Light's mission statement.
Yeah, I mean, the Light is entering its fourth year now, and I think it's time for us to be even more ingrained into the community, the day-to-day life of the community. And so I think Karen is the kind of editor that will be able to take us to this next level.
Just as long as she doesn't try to stop you from coming on here with me.
No, they would never do that. It's free publicity.
Right. Well, we'll have to, you know, once she's settled in and everything, we'll have to have her come on and do some time with us too, so that
absolutely.
She can get to know the audience.
I'd love to tag team on that one.
Yeah, well, absolutely. No, when that happens, we're going to say, sorry, Karen, but Jack's Jack's our employee right now. Jack works for us right now. He's going to start asking you all the hard questions.
I'm a New Bedford Light guy.
I think it's going to be a great addition, and I like the excitement that you have as someone who, you know, has been around a lot of journalism over your career. So you could easily be jaded about changes in management.
I've worked for a lot of good editors, and I know a good editor when I see one, and I really, really am pumped that we have the opportunity to have Karen Bordalo come here.
All right, we got to take a break here. 508-996-0500. We'll be back in just a few moments. More with Jack Spillane as we are turning on the light. And welcome back. We are turning on the light with Jack Spillane. 508-996-0500. If you want to call in with any questions or comments, you can also send in an app chat message as well. So we were talking a little bit about the nature of journalism and what the New Bedford Light does, obviously, is different than what we do here. I would say it's even different than what the Standard Times does, because I don't really see a lot of long-form reporting from them of things. I mean, I was going to say, I don't see them, you know, spending 2 weeks or so on a story, but then I see them writing stories 2 weeks after we've had it. But that's a different thing. So the kind of journalism that New Bedford Light does, just if you can talk to us, and from both yourself as a columnist, but also what you know of the reporters' experiences working over there in these last, you know, 4 years, how would you describe the process that goes into putting together a more long form reporting story like that?
Well, a long form story takes, it is just what it's called, long form, and it takes longer to report it.
It's not just about writing
to
more.
Investigate it. So, you know, we don't do a lot of press conferences, and that's not what we want to do. You may have noticed we are doing some shorter stories of events that take place if we think that they are so significant that the community ought to know about them in a full context, which you can't always get in some of the other media. So we're still evolving, but a long-form story needs time. It needs the skills to do data retrieval. It needs good editing to identify holes in a story that may affect its fairness. And so that all takes time. It takes professional journalism. Our journalists have been to journalism school. They are not, you know, people off the street. They are people who are intelligent and young and hardworking. As I said, we're still a young paper. We're still evolving. We're going to be doing some more shorter form journalism. We already are, too. But the long form will be a big part of our identity always, because, as you said, you can't get it anyplace, because, to be frank, private sector journalism, because we're a nonprofit, but for-profit journalism has been cut to the bone. And so they just simply don't have the reporters in either the electronic or the print media that they used to have. And the reason for that is the internet has taken away a lot of the ads that they used to pay for things. The Standard Times used to have all the real estate ads, all the car ads, all the classified ads.
Obituaries was always a big moneymaker.
Everybody has their own site. And so, I'm old enough to remember when obituaries weren't even paid for. They began to be paid for during my time at the Standard Times. But when we organized ourselves, the people that were organizing it, Ken Hartnett, important people in groups that he was associated with, decided to make this a nonprofit. And that nonprofit has really been key to our identity. We raise money in the same way that public radio or public television does. It can be annoying. You know, we always have things on our site that say, if you like our product, please send us some money. And people say, well, why are they always doing the hard sell? Because otherwise we would have to charge you to go on the site, which we never charge. We also don't have a print product, and we save money there. So we have been thoughtful about the way we approach this. And I think the nonprofit model across the country, a lot of these communities that have lost their print papers are going to this nonprofit model online. And you can do the longer form journalism. You can do some important shorter form things. It's a good model.
Well, we got to take a break here. But what I will say, just to kind of wrap that up, is, you know, when so much of journalism now is about reporting to people what they know they will click on and read, that the New Bedford Light is still, you know, holding up that beacon of journalism of, we're going to tell you what you need to know. as opposed to, you know, necessarily what we're just worried about what people are going to read.
It's eat your vegetables, not just junk food, but we do have things like our fashion,
things
in person, which are featurey types things. You know, there's a lot in the New Bedford Light. The long form is what we're in the investigative stories is what we're known for. But if you look at it, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, I read it every day. I got to take a break here. We will be right back. All right, we are back. The final minute here with Jack Spillane. Jack, we'll talk to you next Friday, I guess.
Yeah. Everything's changing.
Yeah, well, and then I'll...
To suit my tennis schedule.
I'll leave it up to you and Paul if you want to do it on the week that I'm off. But we're going to be turning on the light on Fridays now, again, because of Jack's tennis schedule. But also, I think it's a good thing because, as you said, your stuff usually comes out midweek or later in the week. So when you do have something fresh, we can talk about it sooner.
With my columns come out Thursdays or Fridays usually, so...
And my favorite part about it is on the weeks that you do Town Square Sunday, we'll get to beat Town Square Sunday to your thoughts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.